Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 166 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively right here on the working-class-supported Head-On Radio Network, also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch at crmw.net. Stop by crmw.net, Coal River Mountain Watch, and see for yourself what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day, today being Wednesday, July 23, 2008, and it's good to be back with you. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and it is there that you're going to find links to all of the guests, as well as the guests' websites and audio archives from past shows. You'll find links there to the chat room, which is active, and we have a nice collection of some of our smart people in the chat room. There are also links there for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate music that you hear at the show, all over at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. You'll find there also a link to the Head-On Radio Network's main site, and it is there that you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head-On Radio Network, as well as the PayPal buttons to help it make it easier for you to support the Head-On Radio Network and the fine work that we do. Example, the remote broadcast that you just heard on Bob Kincaid's show, which exists. Amazing speaker. I missed the show the night before, which is apparently the same person, so I'm going to have to go back to the audio archives. That was well worth listening to. I encourage you, if you missed that show, to stop by the White Rose Society, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and you'll find the audio archives for the previous shows for a Bob show, Head-On Radio with Bob Kincaid. The toll-free line, if you'd like to participate with myself and the guest, whom I'll be introducing shortly, toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head-On. That translates into 877-443-2366. And that is toll-free. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. It's area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia, along with the toll-free line. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. And so there's three or four ways to participate. You can participate by email, Peter at headonradionetwork.com. You can use either the toll-free line or the toll line. We'll welcome you either way. The toll line, again, is 304-658-3333. The toll-free line, 877-443-2366. Or you can join us in chat and communicate with the show that way. And you can get to chat by going to strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and you'll find a link there to both the live audio and to the chat room. Our guest this evening, I have given a lot of thought to. Her name is Ariel Tacna. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. We'll ask her when we get her on the show. And that's Ariel Tacna. Now, Ariel lives in southwestern Ohio. Ariel lives with her husband and her daughter and a son and at least one cat. She's a native of that region, but she's lived all over the world, actually. She's fallen in love with France and also India. She hopes to retire to India one day. Ariel started writing when she was only 12 and hasn't looked back since. She's a connoisseur of wine and horses, and she's as comfortable on a farm as she is in the big cities of the world. Should you Google Ariel Tacna, you'll find a list longer than your entire residence. You'll find a string of links for Ariel as that stretches out into the wild blue yonder. Should you look at the list of books and short stories she's written, well, the list is far longer than my arm. In fact, it would take a considerable amount of time just to read through those. And I've told you a little bit about her. What I haven't told you is that Ariel writes gay fiction, romance slash erotica type novels, and which makes her an unusual lady, at least in my book. Then I started thinking about it, and I've been thinking for several days now. Well, she's a woman and she writes gay fiction. How does she do that? And then all of a sudden, it occurred to me just an hour before the show, well, Brokeback Mountain was written by a woman too, based on a 49-page short story. Apparently, there's a real knack amongst our female writers for doing this type of story. Ariel, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. First, Ariel, can you hear me okay?
Yes, no problem at all.
Wonderful. If that should change, the studio has lots of knobs and dials, and they can adjust that up. So you just let us know if the audio quality goes down during the show. Ariel, you're an amazing woman. I hardly know where to begin with you. I can only begin by asking you the question a friend of mine asked me earlier today when we were talking about you. My friend asked, what does her husband think? So let's just start there. Ariel, what does your husband think?
I'm not sure he knows quite what to think. He's always known I was a writer. I started writing long before I met him. But it's only been in about the past 4.5 years, more or less, that I've been writing gay fiction. And actually, at one point, he found a page of a manuscript and looked at it and handed it to me and said, why? And I said, because I like it. And he said, okay. And that's about as much conversation as we've had on the topic.
My stars. Ariel, you've been writing since you were 12 years old. Tell me about the family you come from. Did you come from a family of creative people, painters, musicians, etc.?
Not what you would call traditionally creative. My father is a dental technician. But if you know anything about dental technicians, they make the crowns and the bridges and the whatnot that go in people's mouths. A good dental technician can make a fake tooth that looks exactly like a real tooth. And so I think of my father as an artist, even though he was never a painter or anything like that. My mother's a teacher, well, retired teacher.
But what I came from
was a family that valued literacy. And so I always had a book in my hand. And I think that that's what led to the interest in the telling of tales. And that's what led me to begin writing.
I see. A combination of the artistic and creative ability along with the spoken word. Who could ask for a better background? What did you start writing at 12 years old?
I guess you'd call it 12-year-old romance.
Okay.
The very first thing I ever wrote, I watched the film and read the book with Stanley Robinson and thought that sounded like so much fun, and so I wrote a story of a group of teenagers who got shipwrecked on an island. And they did all kinds of various things to try to survive and eventually were rescued. And when I go back at it and look at it now, I cringe, but I was 12 years old, and when I remember that, I think, okay, it was a place to start.
Well, you know, back in the day, Ariel, I don't know how old you are, nor am I asking, but I'm 55, so I go back a few years, and I remember back when I was in elementary school and going into high school along about those years, there wasn't exactly a large number of female heroines in the various books. Maybe there was Nancy Drew and precious few others. Did you tend to write female roles that were that were more prominent. Often the girls, so to speak, always had to stay in the back seat in the novels.
I did try to make them at least strong characters. I tried to make the story balanced, but I tried not to sell my heroine short. But your comment, I think, about the female characters kind of being in the background, to some extent, that's the fascination for me with writing the gay stories that I write now. You don't have that dynamic, or I shouldn't say don't. You less often have that dynamic when you're dealing with two men, because very often you end up with two very strong characters butting heads. It's a very different dynamic than your average male female dynamic.
Interesting that you would bring that out. We discussed on this program a month or so ago regarding it had to do with the types of relationships that men and women have versus women and women and men and men. And there was the person we were speaking to thought along the terms of that men and men or men and women don't necessarily fight any more often, but oftentimes men and men and women are women and women and women tend to resolve the conflicts quicker because there's not all that baggage of what you're supposed to be as a woman and what you're supposed to be as a man. There's less of that compartmentalism, and so that's a dynamic. Is that the dynamic that you're speaking of?
I think so.
Very interesting. Ariel, where did you go to school?
I graduated from Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, with a bachelor's degree in French and English, and a teaching certification, and I got my master's in second language education from the University of Houston in Texas.
Ah, wonderful. That explains to a degree then how you did so well in France. When did France come along in your life?
The country or the fascination?
The fascination and actually going there.
Well, the fascination started about the same time as the writing did, actually. I started studying French when I was in seventh grade. Had an absolutely amazing French teacher, who I was fortunate to have for 2 years in a row. And it took me about 3 weeks into the beginning of that class in seventh grade for me to decide if there was one thing I ever did in my life, I was going to learn to speak this language. And not just stumbling through, but truly master the language. I went to France for the first time when I was 20, when I was a junior in college as part of an exchange program. Spent a semester in Dijon, France, living with an absolutely wonderful family that I continue to keep in touch with. In fact, I saw them about a month ago. And then went back the year after I graduated from college and taught English in a French high school for a year.
I see. And it's amazing to me, really, that you've indicated that until only a few years ago, you were not writing this genre. What sort of books did you write prior to a few years back?
They probably would still be classified as erotica, but they were head erotica. Some of them were historical, some of them were modern, some of them were fantasy, which is much the same as what can be said for my current erotica. They were always, though, and this is something that's carried over now as well, they were always the story of a relationship, whether it was a relationship building or a relationship falling apart. If you go to my blog, which is a live journal account, Ariel Tasna at livejournal.com, you will see that the title on my live journal is An Exploration of Love. And for me, that's what writing has always been about. Regardless of the setting, regardless of the characters, it's a way to watch and explore two people falling in love or falling out of love or simply being in love, depending on where the story takes place in the course of a relationship.
I see. Well, by the way, Ariel, we're posting the link to your homepage in our chat room, and your homepage is Ariel. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Is it Tacna?
Yes, it is.
Ariel is A-R-I-E-L Tacna. That's T-A-C-H-N-A .com, and you can find out more about her there, and also by tomorrow we'll have a link on the Head On Radio Network main page that will put you through to looking at her work. Ariel, what was the motivation to to begin writing the male gay characters. Had you had gay characters in your other books prior who were peripheral, and it was a natural progression? I'm just wondering how you make that leap.
The leap actually is kind of a funny story and a little bit embarrassing, but that's all right. I'll tell it anyway. The leap started when I started watching the Lord of the Rings film. I was on a chat list that discussed the books, the films, etc., and someone made a comment about fan fiction. Naive little Ariel that I am, I said, "What's fan fiction?" And someone responded, "It's people writing stories about the character." And I thought, "Oh, that sounds cool." So I Googled Lord of the Rings fan fiction and started reading. And started thinking, I can do this. I can do this better. And so I started playing around with Aragorn and Legolas and discovered that I liked the dynamic, that I liked looking at different variations of relationships, that relationships didn't just have to be a man and a woman. And that carried over into my other writing as well.
I see. One wonders about the dynamic of romance. Obviously, when there is romance, there's also the physical side to it, and of course they go hand in hand, so it would be difficult to separate them. Would you say that women are able to write or express the romance side of a relationship better than perhaps male authors, simply because women are maybe more gentle in that respect? I often feel that many times gay men get the sex down, and often get the role model down, either masculine or feminine or somewhere in the middle. There's so many colors in this rainbow, but oftentimes I think men are inarticulate in expressing romance. What are your thoughts along those lines?
I think it unfortunately goes back to gender stereotyping in our society, which is that men are taught to be strong and deal with action, and women are taught to think about and deal with emotion. And so when I sit down to write a character, even when I'm not projecting myself onto that character, I'm writing that character through the filter of my experiences and who I am. And so because that aspect of looking for romance, of looking for love, has always been a part of who I am, that plays into what comes out in my writing. And I think that when you start looking at gender stereotypes and the way that people are expected to act based on whether they're men or women, I think that what you run into is men who don't quite know how to put those feelings in words. It's not that they don't have them. It's just that that's not what they're trained, if you will, to express.
I have a huge smile on my face because, you know, been there, done that. It's absolutely true. Each word you say, just because people grow up and turn out to be gay doesn't mean that in society we were brought up any differently than any other man. In fact, we're taught the same stereotypes as any other man. We're taught the same prejudices and the same role models, and we tend to break out of them to a degree as we get older. But nonetheless, those childhood memories certainly do linger. I completely agree with you that to express the romantic side of a relationship, I don't think men do it very well at all.
And of course there are exceptions, just as there are for women who don't know how to express it. But I do think that as a whole, if you read a female writer, whether it's of gay erotica or heterotica or any other kind of erotica or romance, there is a difference in the focus. In that the female writers tend to have more of a focus on the emotional connection between the characters, which is not to say that the sex isn't there. And the men writers tend to have a greater focus on the physical dynamic between the characters, which is not to say that the emotions aren't there.
Yes. Interesting. One wonders about the success of the movie Brokeback Mountain, which was based on a 49-page short story. By the way, I read that short story prior to seeing the movie, and it reduced me to absolute tears. Beautifully written. What was her name? Annie? Who was it?
I know how to spell her last name. I don't actually know how to pronounce it.
Yeah, something like Perlow or Perlox.
Something like that.
Something like that. But she did it exquisitely, and one wonders if you're not going to be approached, because so many of your novels could easily be adapted to the movie screen. Have you been approached by the movie industry and with questions about this?
I haven't. I would certainly not say no were I approached, but I have not yet been approached.
I see. What about book jackets? Do book jackets play a large part in the sales of a book? You know, we're accustomed to seeing the grocery store type novels, the checkout line type novels, which is usually a dashing man with long hair and the woman with long hair and who's leaning back in his arms, something along those lines. Does that tend to sell? How do you think of the artwork? Is that something you agonize over, the artwork on the cover?
Well, I will admit to being graphically challenged. I don't deal in images. I deal in words. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler. So I tend very much to rely on the advice and counsel of the graphic designers at Dream Spinner Press, which is where I'm being published, and go with what they tend to suggest. If you look at the two covers of the two standalone novels that I have, they are very, very different in style. Of course, they're also very different novels, which explains part of it. The first one, A Summer Place, is a piece of historical fiction. It's set in the 1880s, 1884 season of life in Bar Harbor, Maine. And so the cover is the coast of Bar Harbor with the ship sailing in and then a map of the coastline at the top. Not something that's necessarily going to shout sex, but it will at least hopefully give a reader the idea of the time period in which it's set. The other novel that I have out, that's the beginning of a four-part series, Alliance in Blood, is urban fantasy, which is a term I learned just last week.
Great term. New to me, too.
Well, and the idea is that it is indeed fantasy, because you have magic, you have wizards, you have vampires, but it's not your typical fantasy setting where it's some kind of pastoral other place. It is in an actual, or fictional, in my case, an actual urban setting, which is the city of Paris, and so thus urban fantasy. It's a work of urban fantasy. It is a story of romance. It is a story of the relationship between the characters, but it's also a war story. And it looks at how the war affects these people's lives, just as these people affect and fight the war. And so, again, you have a cover. You see that the two main characters that will remain the main characters through the entire series on the front cover, which you actually have represented is the very first scene when they meet. So this is before we started getting into any of the relationship stuff, when they're still very distrustful of each other because they're a wizard and a vampire, and both of them have been told for as long as they can remember that you absolutely must not trust the other. Talking about those gender stereotypes, theirs aren't gender, it's magical races, but that they have to get over first to work together and then eventually as their relationship develops.
Well, Ariel, I have to say you described the vampire as a bitter, disillusioned vampire, which I have been in pure wonderment over. I'm quite sure. To describe a vampire as being bitter and disillusioned is just genius.
Well, I'm afraid I can't claim responsibility for that. A good friend of mine, when I lived in Houston and was beginning to write this story, Emmett came up with that expression for me. I thought it was brilliant, so I borrowed it with his permission. But I can't actually lay claim to that specific turn of phrase.
Brilliant, and such a twist. I'm told that you are a master at character development, too, that you tend to put lots of a lot of nuance within the sub-characters.
Everyone who shows up on the page has a story. Their story may or may not ever be told, because it may or may not be relevant to the actual story that I'm writing. But that character came from somewhere, has had certain experiences in his or her life, and those things influence how they act now and how they continue to act and how they will act after the pages of the story is over. And I try to know those characters, even the relatively minor ones, because how they act influences the lives of my major characters whose story I'm trying to tell.
Well, I'm seeing the what seems to be a general line of equality amongst your characters. Example, you're talking about the wizard and the vampire, obviously very different, but in many ways equal in terms of magic or power. Then you have in your first book, A Summer Place, the relationship that takes place in the 1840s, I believe. 1880s. And it's the relationship between a builder or a person who builds homes, a contractor, or I'm not sure what kind of builder, but a builder and a blacksmith, which are both on par, at least with the level of masculinity. Is that a theme that you carry throughout the other novels? The reason I ask this is because of my experience in the gay world is that I don't see a whole lot of relationships that where one person is very feminine, the other is fairly masculine. I tend to see more matched relationships in terms of masculinity or roles. Have you seen that too, and is that consistent with your other books?
It is. It's something I feel like is very important. My grandmother was an incredibly unique woman, and this really does tie into answering your question. When I was in high school, I was talking about all the places in the world I wanted to visit, and my grandmother, being a realistic woman, life had made her that way, asked me how I expected to do all of that on a teacher's salary. And she wasn't discouraging me. She just wanted me to be realistic. And being 16, I had a smart answer, because I had a smart answer to everything, and I said, oh, I'll just marry a doctor.
Yeah.
My grandmother, well, I did, but my grandmother looked at me and said, that's fine, you marry whoever you want, but promise me right now that when you graduate from college, you'll spend a year on your own, so that you will know, no matter what happens in your life, that you can take care of yourself. My grandmother married in the 1930s, had six kids, and then her husband died. But my grandmother had gone to pharmacy school. And so when most women in the 1950s with six kids and no husband would have had no choice but to remarry or be destitute, my grandmother had a career and was able to take care of her kids. And so she was very insistent with her grandchildren, particularly with her granddaughters, with this idea that regardless of what happened in our lives, we were any man's equal. And so I think that carries over into my story, that idea that it's important for both people in a relationship to be on equal footing.
I see. That's well said. Ariel, do you find in your personal life that letting people know that you're a writer and perhaps if it comes up, the types of stories that, let me put it like this, even if you weren't writing gay erotica / romance, if you were writing heterosexual erotica and romance, is there generally a stigma associated with that? Do you find, how do people react?
It varies from person to person. I get everything from, cool, can I read it? To, you write what? And you would think that would kind of vary from generation to generation, just because this is an issue that you tend to find somewhat more tolerance with in the younger generation than say with my parents' generation. But that doesn't seem to be the deciding factor. I haven't actually figured out what the deciding factor is, seeing as how one of my sisters said cool and the other sister said what?
What do your sisters do, by the way?
One is a high school teacher and the other is a veterinarian.
I see. Which one said what? The high school
the veterinarian.
Teacher? The veterinarian. Oh,
the
my stars.
Cool. And has bought all of my books.
Well, Ariel, do you find that people base some of their perceptions about you personally as to the type of relationships in the novel example, some of the erotic scenes? Do people seem to think that you're really writing what you would want and what you would like, or your own fantasies, or do people give you a creative license there? What is it like to be in your shoes?
I actually haven't had anyone admit openly to any kind of speculation based on that aspect of my writing, which doesn't mean that they're not all wondering behind their hand, but nobody's actually asked or made any comment to that effect. That said, when you have a relationship in my novels that is functioning the way a relationship should function, I think there is in the relationship, not particularly in the sex, seeing as how I'm in a heterosexual relationship, but in the relationship, there is, to some extent, the way I want to be treated. It, with the idea of the equality, with the idea of these relationships being partnerships where they're working together to build a life, working together to have a future. In sequels, there are some relationships that are not functioning the way relationships should function. Because in a world, the way that one has become, while you certainly have two main characters, they are not the only characters involved in relationships in that universe. In any situation like that, there are going to be relationships that work. There are going to be relationships that don't work. And so that also is playing out in the way in what I write and in some of the scenes. And obviously those are not fantasies of mine, because why would I want to be in a non-functional relationship?
Well, Ariel, is the relationship that you're referring to in this series, which, by the way, I believe you have another volume coming out later this year, Alliance in Blood.
It's actually already out. Covenant in Blood is coming out in November.
That will be the second installment.
Correct.
Is the primary relationship then of a romantic nature between the wizard and the vampire?
Yes.
Very interesting.
It doesn't start out as a romantic relationship. It starts out as a working relationship. But it very quickly, we come to discover some magical influence, becomes a romantic relationship as well.
I see. Well, you know, when one says wizard and one says vampire, the images that come to mind are, I would think, for the huge majority of people, would be the stereotypical or the traditional wizard, which is the guy in the pointy hat who's kind of old and a big white beard, and the vampire looking very dark and scary and maybe a little bit green. Judging from looking at your book covers, I'm seeing that these two are both attractive, good-looking young men. Is that correct?
Yes. Alain, who is the wizard on the cover of the first volume, is in his early 30s. You won't know he's a wizard if you pass him on the street, unless you happen to see him doing magic. In the universe that I've created, magic is not a secret. The people who are wizards aren't hiding the fact that they're wizards. They're not advertising the fact that they're wizards, necessarily. But everybody knows, sitting on the subway in Paris, that the person sitting next to you could be a wizard. If it's after dark, they know that the person sitting next to them could conceivably be a vampire or a werewolf or some other magical race. And so you end up with wizards and vampires of every shape and size and color and age, depending on when they were, in the vampires' cases, depending on when they, in their lives, they were turned. In the wizard's case, depending on where in their lives they are at the moment that this war takes place.
Well, then Ariel, in the world that you've created for these characters, then it is not some sort of alternate universe, as you would, for instance, Lord of the Rings, that was a totally alternate universe, different world, Dracula, these all take, this, you've mentioned Paris is the reason I bring this out. Are you staging this as if it were modern time America, but an alternate type of, how does this work?
It's modern Paris. The only difference is that there are wizards and vampires running around. Everything, if you walked into Paris tomorrow, and the things that you would see as you were walking down the street, the buildings that you would see, the culture that you would find, that's where this story takes place. With the addition of the wizards and the vampires and the magic and some government entities that come about that are necessitated by the presence of the magicians, the wizards.
I see. Well, regarding the characters, then that's Alan and Orlando. Is Alan the wizard and Orlando the vampire?
Yes, that's correct.
Does Orlando come from a family of vampires? Pardon my ignorance. I just tried to imagine, because this particular series, this is going to, you're writing, what, 8, 9 different books on this?
Four.
This is huge.
Four? Yeah.
Somehow, it must be over the next, it must have been, I saw 2009. Some of them are coming out in 2009. Yeah.
Coming out this year, Alliance that came out in May, and Covenant and Blood that's coming out in November, and then Conflict and Blood is due out next May of 2009, and Reparation and Blood, which is the final installment, is due in November of 2009.
Well, one recalls the anticipation that people waited for the new novels in the who was the Dumbledore guy and the Thank you. Okay, are you getting that sort of anticipation? Because I'm reading that people are saying that your first book was a page-turner. I read it in one sitting. I read it all night. And comments like this go on and on and on if you start looking through the comments over at Amazon and some of the blogs about your books. Are people waiting with huge anticipation?
I have gotten some emails to that effect, yes. It's always a little bit difficult to tell when you deal with the kind of fiction the kind of sales that we're doing, because the vast majority of the sales of my books are online, either through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or directly from the Dream Center website. So there isn't the phenomenon of people lining up at the bookstore, because most bookstores don't carry a large selection of gay fiction at this point. Although I'm hoping to see that change as time goes on. But at the moment, there's not a bookstore for people to go line up on. So I don't know that we'll see it the same way that you would with something like Harry Potter, but I do certainly feel like there are people who are waiting to see what the second book is going to look like, and then from there, I hope, the third and the fourth as well.
Well, Ariel, I've seen it listed in looking around today. I've seen it listed at Barnes & Noble. Is it also available in the brick-and-mortar Barnes & Noble?
I know that if you go to a brick-and-mortar Barnes & Noble and ask them, they can order it for you. I don't know whether they're stocking it on individual shelves in terms of actually having it available for people who just happen to walk in the store. That's a decision that tends to be made by the individual managers of the individual stores.
I see. Have you actually completed the writing of the second book at this point in time?
I'm in the process of editing it, but there is a complete draft of it, yes.
I see. Are there any hints that you would give out to your readers that you are my headed in a direction you don't want to go? Come on.
Well, let's see, what can I tell you without giving too much away? There will be 6 partnerships that are followed fairly closely through the rest of the series. We have Alan and Orlando in the first one already. So we'll have 5 new partnerships, vampire and wizard working together, that will develop in various degrees of relationship over the course of the remaining volumes. Let's see, what else can I tell you that won't give too much away? Part of the problem is trying to remember just what's in Volume 2 and not give away even more than I want to.
I understand. The books, you, since you have
story,
an overall...
I yeah. wrote it as one story and then realized that it was far too long to fit in one novel. And so, a little bit like Lord of the Rings, heaven forbid that I should compare myself to Tolkien, but in this one respect I'll do so. Lord of the Rings is one story that he had to publish in three volumes because of the length of it. And this is also true, in my mind, of the Partnership and Blood series. It's one story told in four installments.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I'm also told that you're a huge fan of the Lord of the Rings, and in fact, you have not only read the series, but you've been to the theater to see it at least five times, at least the first one. Am I correct there?
Actually, I went to see, when Return of the King came out, I saw it four times in 24 hours.
Oh, my stars, Ariel, that's great.
No, three times. There was a reason for it. I was able to get, I lived in Houston at the time, I was able to get a ticket to Trilogy Tuesday when they showed all three films back to back. My husband wasn't able to come with me because he had exams that day in medical school. So I went and saw it and enjoyed it so much that I decided the next morning, because of break, I didn't have to be at school, decided the next morning that I'd go see it. Got home, my husband finished up the last of his exams, and I'm going to go see Return of the King. Do you want to go with me? So I said, sure. And so I saw it three times within 24 hours of it coming out.
Amazing. So it's something that you must have internalized. You can't. You really felt that movie then.
Yes.
And the books.
Yes. Very much so. But, and yet I hadn't read the book until after I saw the first film. Which tends to be the I shouldn't say tends to be, is the reverse of many people of my age. I saw a lot of my students who had not read the book, were not familiar with it, saw the film and then went and read the book. But most of my peers had read the books when they were in high school or college. I had started, had gotten about 50 pages in, and I had borrowed the book from a boyfriend at the time, and we broke up, so I gave him the book back. If you've read Lord of the Rings, I don't know if you have or not, but if you've read it, the first 150 pages are Tolkien's love poetry to the English countryside, to the Shire. Not the most exciting reading. I hadn't gotten far enough in when this particular boyfriend and I broke up to have gotten to the story and to have had an intrinsic reason to continue, and my reason for reading it because he liked it was gone because he was gone, so I didn't pick it back up until after I saw the first film and realized that there was actually a story there worth finding out what happened, and since the first film only told the first third of the story, I wasn't going to wait another year to find out what happened.
Interesting that you would put it that way. I have read The Lord of the Rings. I have not read the others. Of course, I've seen the entire trilogy or the entire series for the movies, but you put it as a love poem to the English countryside. How well said that is. It really inspires one to actually see it. It's such a personal and explicit sort of a love.
It resonates with me a little bit, not so much in terms of the English countryside, because I have only been to England a couple times and then only to London, but with the way that I write about Paris and the way that I try to not just name the place where the people are, but to actually describe it. There's a scene in Volume 2, fairly close to the end, where the leader of the vampires in Paris, Jean, is at the Notre Dame Cathedral. And I laugh and call this section as he's walking past the cathedral and remembering it being built, he being a relatively ancient vampire. And thinking about what it is that makes this building special in Paris and in French history. So, not to the 150 pages length that Tolkien went, but nonetheless trying to do more than just drop the names of these buildings and assume that everybody knows what they look like.
Ariel, for so many years, being 53, I remember when the only books that were written by gays or about gays or any relationship to or any movies about were always pure pornography. And it came as such a wonderful breath of fresh air to me when I began discovering, as a member of Netflix, all the wonderful gay romances that are available there, plugging Netflix unintentionally. But there is a wonderful I can only call it a subgenre of that has to do with gay romance, and it was such a relief to me because having never seen it presented in that way, is in fact this something fairly new? And what is the history of gay romance novels? Because we've always been presented as such a tortured or just purely sexual group of people.
Right. I'm not probably the best person to answer that question. I started looking into the possibility of publication about 2.5 years ago with nothing actually ready to send, because I didn't feel that I could pitch the Partnership in Blood series when it wasn't complete. And Summerfight was also in draft. But knowing that they were being written, I started looking around, and I found one publisher in Australia who does a lot of online publishing, e-books, that kind of thing. And then about 2 years ago, not quite yet, I found the Dream Spinner Press website, and they were doing a call for submissions for novella length stories, 20,000 to about 50,000 words, with the idea of putting together an anthology of long short stories to be published. And so wrote something specifically for that, submitted it, was accepted, and had that published May a year ago, which was Dream Spinner's first publication. In the meantime, got A Summer Place finished and submitted to them, and so I can proudly say that that was the second publication.
I'll be doing it.
And now, of course, if you go and look at their website, they have quite the catalog. They put out two volumes a month. I have one that came out again this month, a novella length again in an anthology, Sandals and Sodomy, that is set in the ancient Mediterranean Greece, Troy, it's set. And so in that respect, I think you're seeing more and more and more, with the success of Brokeback Mountain, with the success of TV shows like Queer as Folk, which I've never seen, but I've heard about it, people are beginning to realize that there might be more to gay erotica than just, as you said, pornography.
I'll be darned. So what a match made in heaven. You at the same time begin exploring and Dream Spinner Press, you were the first person they published. What range of books does Dream Spinner publish? Is it purely gay erotica?
Yes.
I see. And do they publish any? I'm wondering about our lesbian friends. Are there other writers who write lesbian novels, or do you, or have you?
I haven't written a lesbian novel. In the Partnership in Blood universe, there is a featured lesbian relationship, not in volume one, but it does come up in volume two and three and four. Dream Spinner does not have at this point any standalone lesbian novel. I don't know whether they'd be interested in one or not. That would be a question for Elizabeth North, who is the CEO, head editor, runs the company, although looking at their website, it is advertised as publishers of male-male romance, which doesn't answer your question for the lesbian listeners, except to say that while they do stated to publishers of Male Male Romance they've accepted my entire partnership in Blood series, despite the fact that there are relationships in that, in those novels that are not just male male.
I see. Errol, do you still teach?
Yes, I do.
I see. And what grade level do you, are you a college professor?
High school.
High school. And pray tell, do the parents know?
No.
Obviously, I would hope not. I would hope not, because that, you know, you such a volatile issue. It's so many crazies in the woodwork.
Yes. A few of my colleagues know. A few carefully selected colleagues know.
Yes.
But no, on the whole, that's not something that I bring up at school.
I see. So that's just an amazing thought that your high school English teacher, do you teach English? Could be
no,
writing
French.
French, okay. Oh my! What do your kids think about it? Do you have a son and a daughter? Is that right?
They're 3 years old and 10 months old. They don't. They know that mom spends time at the computer. But that's about as much as I understand at this point.
I see. That's all they need to know. I had no idea in reading through the information. So this is so many new things are happening for you. You've got new children, and you've got the new books, and you are an incredibly busy person. How do you keep up with all this?
Very carefully. No, I've always been someone who was happiest when my plate was overflowing. So, you know, I have time allotted for various things. I have the time at school and a certain amount of time after school that I spend doing the schoolwork. I come home and I have a certain amount of time. The kids have a relatively early bedtime. They're still young, so I can still make them go to bed at 8, and that gives me 3 hours in the evening to get some writing done before I have to go to bed.
Well, yeah, Ariel, you've in addition to A Summer Place and the series that you're writing now, you've written some short stories, and I have to tell you that the title of your short stories book just is genius, and it's called Size Matters, Short Stories Long Enough to Satisfy. What an amazing, who came up with that? That's divine. That's delicious.
Elizabeth North, who is the director of Dreamstone Press, came up with that. I have one novella in that anthology. I'm one of five. So that's not mine alone. My story in that is called Healing in His Wings. That's a science fiction story.
I see. Well, are you going to continue to write short stories and or try to do another novel or novella during the period of time that you're writing this series?
I'll see what develops. I have some truly short stories that are available only as e-fiction through Dreamspinner Press's website. And one of those is an occasional series that I write, the James Lover's Play series. Two characters in an established relationship who have games night that tends to be role plays, and they take turns from month to month deciding who gets to decide what situation they're playing out that night. And so one of those is currently available. Elizabeth has two more that she's accepted. I don't know when they're going to be put up on the website yet. And I have a couple more ideas playing around in the back of my head for those. And those are the kind of things that I can sit down and write in a weekend. They're 30 pages long at the most. Most of them aren't even that long. I have not thought about another novel-length story. I shouldn't say that. I haven't thought about another novel-length story by myself. I do a fair amount of writing with another woman where we do a lot of co-writing, brainstorming, that kind of thing. And we have several ideas going that we're working on from time to time. Obviously, we'll have to finish them and then get them cleaned up and polished and see whether those are those things that we decide we're interested in submitting to Dream Center or elsewhere, although I've been pleased enough with my relationship with Dream Spinner that I'll always give them the right of first refusal.
Well, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
Well, Dream Spinner, I'm wondering, is that the is that the only provider of this? Are there others? This seems to be very new, because you were looking and Dream Spinner came along about the same time. So this is all fairly new, is it not?
It's fairly new. There are other publishing houses. There's one in Australia that's Torshare, Torquere, I think is how it's spelled. There is one that's called Man Love Press, I think. They're out there. They tend to all be small. They tend to all be relatively new, relatively in the past 2 or 3 years for the most part. As I said, I found Dream Spinner right about the time I was ready to start submitting things. They liked my work, so I keep submitting things to them. That whole
Ariel,
thing
would you,
once you're
Ariel,
known by an editor, it's easier to get that person's attention the next time you're ready to submit something, as opposed to going someplace where you're not known yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering about, apparently Dream Spinner has picked up some other writers. It seems like it would be like almost a close-knit community, but I imagine there's competition too. Now, are you the only female writer, and also do you know the others? Is this what kind of a group?
The others, and no, I'm not the only female writer. In fact, the majority of us are female. I have the Dream Spinner website up in front of me. I'm sitting here counting. 1, 2, 3, I think. Yeah, four men, I think. Out of a list of about 20 authors.
You're kidding me. What a hoot.
And of that list, I have met 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of the others.
That is just amazing to me to realize there's so many women who write this genre. Who knew? I mean, it's just... Ariel, tell us about Moby Pocket. What is that?
Moby Pocket is a reading device for e-books that is, I believe, available through Amazon, although somebody will have to correct me if I'm wrong. And so it's another way, kind of like a palm or whatever, to take the book with you in electronic format if you don't want to walk around carrying the hardback, or I shouldn't say hardback, they're trade back, but carrying the paperback book.
I see. So it's a piece of hardware that you actually own that can display various, more than one book, should you choose to?
I believe so.
I
don't have one, so that, but I have seen, I know that my book's available that way.
I see. And apparently your books are available as PDF files, which most of our listeners, we have a pretty smart group of listeners. That's, I think anyone listening to the show would know what a PDF is. Are the PDFs available through Barnes & Noble? Does Barnes & Noble sell the electronic versions? How does that work? Does Amazon?
Amazon, you can get them. You can get them straight from the Dream Spinner from the Dream Spinner Press website, which anything that Dream Spinner sells, you can order directly from them, should you choose to. One of the advantages of doing that, for example, very often when they have books first come out, they'll have a certain number of signed copies that will be available, which are only available through the Dream Spinner Press website as opposed to, say, from Barnes & Noble or Amazon. So, but I believe Barnes & Noble and Amazon have the e-book as well as well, it looks like Barnes & Noble online just has the paperback stuff, although I'm pretty sure Amazon has the e-books as well.
I see. So one would go to, what is it, dreamspinnerpress.com? Is that the easiest way to locate your...
Yes, you can go to dreamspinnerpress.com, and then they have on their sidebar, they have a place for authors. If you click on authors, and you have a list of all the authors that they published, you can click on my name, and from there it will give you a list of all the titles that are available through Dream Center Press. You can browse around the website, and it shows you not only what I have out, but what the other authors do as well. Everything that's published to them is available directly through them. Also, all the links to my website, my blog, and all are there. Of course, you have the author on my website, which you have. And I occasionally find time to write a little bit of free e-fiction and stick it up on my blog for people who are following along at home. Publication announcements, all of that, go up on my blog as well.
I see. Ariel, something you said prompts me to wonder. Most of the writers are female. Are there any male writers who use female names that write these novels? One wonders.
Not that I'm aware of, which doesn't answer your question, because as I said, I've met 9 of the others on the list. I haven't met everyone, so I don't actually know. The ones who I have met who use female names are in fact female, and the ones who use male names are in fact male. But that doesn't answer your question.
Are you the only writer that is working on a series at this point? That you said 4 books at this time? Four book series?
I am the only one that has had a series accepted that I'm aware of. Of course, I don't claim to be aware of everything that Dream Spinner has accepted. I do know that one of the authors, who happens to be a friend of mine, is working on a series as well. The first one has been submitted. In their case, it truly is a series as opposed to a serial, where you have, in my case, it truly is one story in the 4 volumes, whereas theirs is more along the lines of, say, the Nancy Drew stories, where with obviously adult characters, etc., but where each mystery is a standalone, but characters that carry over from one to the next.
I see. Ariel, one wonders, there's such a long list of books that you have written, that one wonders, you've put out a lot of work prior to beginning this phase of your writing. Are all of these other books available through, Dream Press?
No.
Dream Spinner, rather?
No, the things that I wrote in younger years are safely buried in a box in my basement.
Oh, we're not going to go there and talk about all of that, because there really is a huge body of work that you've written. It's not like you just got off the turnip truck.
I think I sat down and counted, and before I graduated from college, I had written 8 novel-length manuscripts.
Wow. Any plays?
All of which are safely buried in a box in my basement.
Any plays, Ariel?
No. Nor any poetry. I tend to go straight for the prose.
I see. Well, this has been amazingly interesting. I'm still a bit, it's difficult to wrap my head around. You know, having grown up as a gay guy in the rural South, discussing gay erotica is actually, not my easiest topic, to tell you the truth. And when it was first suggested to have you on the show, I thought, oh my God, like, how am I going to handle this? I like totally can't. So thank you for leading me through this, because I you know what I'm saying.
Well, thank you actually, for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
It's been wonderful. And as I said, we've been posting the link in the website. Would you like to give out the links again? And also, I've asked you so many questions. I've been all over the map. There may be something that you'd like to tell us that I haven't touched upon. Is there something you'd like to say and give us the information about purchasing?
No, I think we've had a most interesting conversation, and I didn't really know exactly what we'd be talking about when we came in, so I didn't particularly prepare anything. Anyone who is interested, my website is www.arieltachna.com. My blog is arieltochner.livejournal.com, and all of my published work is available through Dream Center Press, dreamcenterpress.com.
Well, Ariel, you've been a delightful guest, and I've only discovered you over the past couple of weeks when it was first proposed to have you on the show, and now I'm intensely curious. So I'm going to have to at least read Summer Place. That I could, I'm sure I can read that. I'm the sort of person. Here's how I am. Like when Stephen King writes these three or four books that they're all part of the same story, like a series. Always wait till they're all out before I read them. And then I read them all. For some reason I have a real hard time waiting. So that being the case, I'd probably do Summer Place.
I've been accused of leaving my readers hanging from time to time when I'm working on a series like this. So if you have a hard time waiting, you may do better to wait until the book comes out.
Yeah, one last question. Are any public libraries handling these books that you know of?
Not that I know of. Which
certainly
doesn't mean that they're not, but if they are, it hasn't been brought to my awareness.
Well, all right. Well, that's a great story, Ariel, and the fact that you're still a high school teacher. The nuances, you just never know the kind of stories we're going to hear here. The world is indeed an interesting place, is it not?
It is indeed.
It is indeed. Ariel, thank you for being on Strictly Confidential.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, good evening to you. And, folks, that was Ariel Tacna. Lives in Ohio with her husband and her daughter and her son and at least one kitty cat. I never did clarify how many. And she is a French teacher in high school and writes gay romance novels / erotica. And you just never know who you're going to run into on Strictly Confidential. So it's, let's see, we're at the top of the hour. So I suppose what we ought to do, if we were normal, which we certainly are not around here, we ought to go ahead and do a top of the hour break. So what we'll do is do that, and we'll come back in just a few minutes and continue with the second half of the show. I want to point out to you that the DJ across the street in the gay bar across the street tonight is Rick Ashman from Seattle, DJ RXMX. He has a great set for us, and he's been scheduled several times. We've had to postpone it because of some Internet issues, but we are glad to have Rick with us tonight, DJ RXMX. And so let's go to the top of the hour break. And this is Peter Godbold. This is Strictly Confidential. We'll be right back.
Stage! Stan, what do you want to tell the world about this stunning almost victory?
It's really cool that we beat the spread against the Cowboys.
Yeah!
And it's okay to be gay.
What?
Being gay is just part of nature and a beautiful thing.
What the hell is he talking about?
Well, you can dance every dance with the guy who gave you the eye, let him hold you high.
Nice to say.
And you can smile at the style of the girl who held your hand and said goodbye.
But don't forget who's taking you home and it's who I'm going to be. So
we'll be right back.
he's back. Riding across America on a horse named Strictly Confidential. A man who knows his way around a pair of chaps. Here's your host, Peter Godbold.
And indeed, I am back. Riding across the country, in fact, the world, on a horse named Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and this is Strictly Confidential, and you're listening to a Wednesday evening show live on the Head On Radio Network. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, Head On. That translates into 877-443-2366, unlimited long distance. You could use that. That's 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. Oftentimes, at the end of these shows, I run out of the room like my dress was on fire, because I usually run right up to the very last seconds of the show, and I often, in fact, regularly, I forget to tell you what a blessing and how wonderful it is to have our news ninjas. The news ninjas assist all of the hosts on the Head On Radio Network, and they work very hard, and they do it as volunteers who are not paid or looking for news articles that would be of interest to the listeners. They tend to fine-tune it, and environmental articles are often sent to John, and I often get LGBT type articles. They do research for all of us, and I just wanted to take a moment to thank you guys, because in fact we could not do this without you. It's very important to have you there. Going to do a little catch up here over some things that have happened just recently. First, let's talk about North Carolina just briefly. A bullying bill in North Carolina just died over the gay controversy. It was legislation designed to combat bullying in public schools, and it is dead, stone cold dead, according to several state senators who've worked on the proposal. The Senate bill, which would have listed gay students as potential harassment targets on the list of possible victims, died absolutely stone cold. And the reason? Because it listed sexual orientation. Oh, no, no, no. Dare we not actually include a group who really needs the protection? Not that the others don't. But the bill became very controversial in North Carolina because no one wanted to acknowledge that school children might be the targets of bullying. You can count on the fact that groups such as the Christian Action League and the North Carolina Family Policy Council did not want the law to come into effect. You see, they're too busy selling recovery centers and the fix-a-fag organizations, where you too, for only $50,000 in 4 or 5 years of your life, can find out that it's all useless. There are no cures. They were warning the legislature that the gay rights groups and the activists, such as moi, would use a bullying provision to leverage other rights. And God forbid, we wouldn't want anything like that to happen. The bill would have simply required that bullying be reported. You see, as it is now, it's a well-kept secret. And the reason no one thinks we need it is because no one's required to report it. Sort of a catch-22, very much like the way state systems work nationwide in terms of anti-violence laws. The senators said they had enough votes to pass it, but only if everyone showed up, which they made sure they did not. You see, even though there were enough votes to pass it, no one actually wanted to go down on paper as having passed it. So that opportunity passed is over in North Carolina, at least for the time being. Bullying is already against school policy, but it's for other groups of people. The only way it's going to be seriously addressed is if people begin talking about it. And one of the senators says the failure of this bill to pass sends a bad message. Well, do you think? Wanted to bring this up about Egypt. Did you know that two-thirds, that is two out of three Egyptian men, harass women? Why, it's a custom. Nearly two-thirds of Egyptian men have admitted to sexually harassing women in the highly populated country, the Arab country. And the majority say women themselves are to blame. Sound familiar? Women are to blame. Yes, those hussies, they are to blame for their maltreatment. A survey says, women are themselves to blame. And the forms of harassment reported by Egyptian men, whose country, by the way, attracts millions of foreign tourists each year, include touching, are ogling women, shouting explicit sexual remarks, and exposing their genitals to women. Hi, honey, you want to see something party? Dear God in heaven. I wonder how many of those women are actually lesbians hysterically behind their burqas. Or do they wear burqas in Egypt? I imagine some do. Sexual harassment has become an overwhelming and very real problem experienced by literally all women in Egyptian society on a daily basis. Now, what this means is that even though there are only two-thirds of the men who admit to sexually harassing women, you can damn well count on the fact that 100% of women have been harassed by two-thirds of the men. Egyptian women and, in fact, female visitors as a whole complain of very much persistent sexual harassment on Egyptian streets. Despite the socially conservative nature of this traditional Muslim society, why is the word conservative always mixed up in bull manure like this? Repression, boy, it's the way to go. This behavior could have repercussions on Egypt's tourism industry, do you think? It's a major income for the country. 98% of foreign women say they've had an experience of being harassed in the country, survey says. Survey of more than 2,000 Egyptian men and women and 109 foreign women, and the vast majority of Egyptians believe that sexual harassment in Egypt is on the rise, citing worsening economic situations and a lack of awareness or traditional religious values. Conservative and traditional religious values always lead to BS like this. It said that 62% of Egyptian men reported perpetrating harassment, that's 62%, while 83% of Egyptian women reported having been sexually harassed. The others would not talk about it. Half those women who would talk about it said that the abuse occurred every day. That's not every other day. That's something you have to look it up and look forward to every single day. When you go to the bus or when you go to the market, that's something you get to deal with every single day. Oh, and did I mention honor killings? I'll talk about that in just a few minutes if I have time. So these are the old laws where you can kill your sister or your niece if they embarrass you. And, of course, being harassed sexually and, in fact, touched sexually, if that were found out, would be that'd be enough reason to kill the woman. Honor killing. It was a terrible blow to the family honor. She got touched. Lord have mercy. Only 2.4% of Egyptian women will report it to the police. Most of the women say they don't want anyone's help, and many feared that reporting it would hurt their reputations. Can you say honor killing? And the vast majority of women did nothing when confronted with sexual harassment. The survey says that most Egyptian women believe that the victim should remain silent. Well, damn. Those are great rules if you're a male chauvinist bunch of pig society. Those are great rules. You teach the women they should remain silent and you do whatever you want. Yep, great rules. Wonder who set those down in stone. And here we go. Survey says 53% of the men blame the women are bringing on the sexual harassment. Yes, these are harassment magnets. And says that these women enjoyed it, or they provoked it by dressing in a way that was indecent. I wonder what that means. Open-toed shoes? Women often agreed. This goes to show you, male or female, when you're brought up in the same sick society, you're taught the same rules. Egyptian women and men interviewed, most of them will tell you that women who wear tight clothes deserve to be harassed. And it added that most women agree that women should be home by 8 p.m. Also goes into some detail about Egyptian women who are being harassed because they dress conservatively using the scarf, and there are other women who are harassed because they don't wear the scarf. And harassment takes place in the streets and public transportation, tourism destination, educational institutes, the marketplace, you name it. You get up in the woman, you get up in the morning, you look down, you realize you're a woman. Well, guess what's in store for you today? Harassment. By the way, it looks like we may have at least the first reported case of male honor killing. You know, they honor kill the, or the honor of the family kill women often, should the woman embarrass the family. Well, you can just imagine if your brother was gay or your nephew was gay, he'd be terrible embarrassment for the family. However, it's never been reported, at least as far as is known in Istanbul, that someone was honor killed because he was gay. But apparently this is the first time one has actually been reported. This man was a Turkey's gay poster boy. He was a very good-looking, very masculine man, extremely good-looking. He was killed. His friends believe that it's because of the friction between liberal society and conservative traditions. Well, do you think? His name is Hamet. He's 26 years old, a physics student, and he represented Turkey in the International Gay Gathering at San Francisco last year. Well, he was shot leaving a cafe this week. He was fatally wounded. The student tried to flee. The 26-year-old tried to flee the attackers in his car. However, he lost control and crashed on the side of the road and died shortly afterwards in the hospital. His friends believe he is the victim of the country's first gay honor killing. And again, I point out to you, it is by no means the first gay honor killing. It is simply the first reported gay honor killing. Well, I've always maintained that liberation for women is liberation for everybody. Don't believe it, look at stuff like this. He was a victim of the old mentalities, said one of the folks from the gay rights group called Lambda. He said, I feel helpless. We're trying to raise awareness in this country, and the more visible we become, the more we open ourselves up to this sort of attack. Turkey was all but closed to the world until 1980, and then the new rules came along. Of course, the issues of women's sexuality and family pressures. You know, the media over there just laughs it off. Over here, the media is afraid to report it. Over there, they at least report it, but it's a point of humor. They just laugh off the harassment, that sort of thing. Now, I think we may have time for one other little go-to-break track I had wanted to run for you guys this evening. And before we bring up our gay bar across the street with none other than DJ RXMX. And so this is a short one. We'll run this at a 10:24 p.m. go-to-break. Hit it, Acton.
We were asked to put together a study on the ex-gay reality. A psychiatrist approached us, you've written about this, and asked us if we could pull out some of the success stories from our files. And I went to Gary, I said, oh my God, we've got to find success stories, you know. What are we going to do? But we managed out of that, say, 400, 800 files that we had there, and we literally counseled hundreds of people over this time. We found 30 people that we thought might make the grade. Now, this is really bad research design. You don't
like... We were trying to affect the outcome, of course, make it positive.
And he and this Christian psychiatrist and his wife interviewed those 30 people, and out of those 30 people found 11 that they felt had made significant change. We were two of the 11.
And we're still using that study today.
Hold on tight to your dream. Hey!
Can resist ELO. Great song, that is. One of my all-time favorites, by the way. And by the way, these honor killings we're just talking about is very, very common. Where conservative social values resist the rule of law. Sound familiar? In Turkey, a government study estimates that in just the last 5 years alone, more than 1,000 honor killings have been committed. Honor, I tell you, honor. Victims were mostly young women murdered by male relatives for transgressing social rules. An untold number of them were men. Just a quick mention that Larry Craig, Wide Stance Larry Craig, I told you recently, has introduced an amendment to the Constitution, along with several others, to permanently enshrine discrimination in the Constitution of the United States. One man and one woman. He has also come out today, Senator Wide Stance Larry Craig, supporting Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and basically says we shouldn't be forcing this experiment during wartime, and it's going to make the military less capable of protecting us, he said as he stuck his door out, his head out of the toilet stall and spoke to a reporter. Let's see, time for Rick Ashman. I'm so pleased to have Rick. We haven't run one of Rick's sets in quite a while. Rick is in Seattle. If you'd like to find out more about Rick Ashman, he's been a guest on the show. You can find out about him at djrxmx.multiply.com. That's djrxmx.multiply.com. And Rick has sent us a special sampler in this evening, and we're going to gather up our raincoats and our little umbrellas and our pocketbooks and our purses and shuffle on across to the little gay bar across the street that we formerly called the Paradise Dance Hall. Roll it, Atkins. Thank you. Was none other than Rick Ashman, DJ RXMX, in the Emerald City, Seattle. If you'd like to find out more about DJ RXMX, you can find that out at djrxmx.multiply.com. I must tell you, I was shaking my head after reviewing, thinking about what went on during the show tonight. Rick is one of four straight DJs. We have so many wonderful DJs, but Rick Ashman is one of four straight DJs who play music that's right at home in gay clubs. Then the guest this evening was a married woman with two kids who's a French teacher in high school and writes gay romantic erotica. I mean, what's going on? I didn't get the memo, kids. It occurs to me that we all have a hell of a lot more in common than what we have apart. Need to tell you that tomorrow evening, don't miss it, Debbie Jacobs, disco diva star extraordinary. What a story. What a voice. Tomorrow evening at 9 p.m., Debbie Jacobs. Also coming up very soon will be Amuka, also a club diva with a huge story to tell. You will not want to miss Amuka. And also Glenn has set up Lucy Neal. Lucy Neal has sung with the Hornets and Giorgio Moroder, Claudia Berry, Donna Summer. She's been in the musical Hair. She goes back. You don't want to miss Lucy Neal. We'll be announcing the date for that soon. What a lineup. Also next Wednesday we have John Simpson, who's a man who writes gay fiction slash erotica. So we're going to cover the gay fiction slash erotica so that we have no more questions by the time we cover it all. We're looking forward to having each and every one. Need to tell you that John is having a couple of computer issues this evening, so and Bob is traveling. So, in fact, there will not be a horn section this evening, and we will not be having a all-foxed-up section with John this evening. So the programming will go into rerun status at this point in time. And tomorrow night, we're all back, fresh and new, and twice as evil and bigger and badder than ever before. Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night. And in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too,